They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Sue Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights.
WBR FM Fairfax.
A service of Fairfax Public Access and Cox Communications.
94.5 Cable FM.
Cox Cable Channel 37.
Comcast Cable Channel 24.47.
And webcasted to the world in real audio at FCAC.org.
WBR FM Fairfax.
On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory common ownership development. It is broadcast live from WBR Fairfax, Virginia. Join us as we explore the world of common ownership development, the fastest growing form of residential development in America today. This housing concept includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes that are part of a mandatory homeowners association. Unfortunately, this type of housing is not as utopian as its advocates would have us believe. Living in a mandatory homeowners association means giving up part of the American dream. It means giving up constitutional rights and control over one's most valuable asset, one's home. Living in a mandatory homeowners association means leaving the American zone.
WBR Fairfax Radio, you're on the Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew, and joining us on the Commons today, we have Val Lucier. Val was the first volunteer chief election monitor and has the distinctive honor of being the first and to date the only certified election monitor in Florida. He has recently written and published a book called Condo Board Election Revolt, How Florida's First Condo Ombudsman Became the 500-Pound Gorilla. It's been an interesting book to read. I've got a million, and I'm exaggerating slightly, little tabs and notes all over the book. I found it fascinating. Val, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sue. I thank you for having me on, and I'm ready to take care of all your little tabs.
You're ready to... Well, I'm going to do as little talking as possible because, folks, In a little over 100 pages, Val has got a ton of information in here. Now, one of the things that we hear all the time is that associations are these democratic little engines that keep humming. It's democracy up close and personal, which is what CAI says. But in order to have a true democracy, you ought to be able to have elections, proper elections. And in the book, Val, you made a good point. And this, the point was that as far as the state of Florida goes, there's only one restriction. You're talking about who can run for the board. But in society, we don't take away people's right to vote because we don't like them or we don't like the way they're going to vote.
That's right.
But that happens in associations, and that's probably one of the big things that you dealt with.
Well, I dealt with it not from a bylaw standpoint, because, like you say, there's a lot of restrictions. Sometimes if you're not a permanent resident, you can't run for the board. My experience primarily was where people who thought they were on the ballot did not end up on the ballot sometimes. And I covered that in the book in one particular incident where an individual had submitted his candidacy, did it all on time, and he wasn't on the ballot. And sure enough, election night, we come walking in and we're confronted with that individual and says, hey, look at this. And unfortunately, frustrating as it was for us, we could do absolutely nothing about that except tell the unit owner, well, we'll talk to the board, and you really have to file with the division a complaint. But the election tonight goes on as it does. The only way it could have stopped is if the board would have said, yeah, we made an error, and we'll correct it. But in that particular instance, I'm talking about the individuals. When I said that to the individuals, said, well, don't bother. They already know. They're not going to do anything about it. So that's the kind of things you can run into.
Val, let's take this from the beginning. You had the DPPR, and they were responsible for, in Florida, they were responsible for overseeing condominiums. They did such a shoddy job that the homeowners or the condo owners themselves were upset and in revolt. So, we adopt the ombudsman's program. And the first ombudsman is Virgil Rizzo, and he did a fantastic job. And you worked with Virgil. Tell us how all that started. You want to lay the groundwork so that my listeners understand where
sure.
we're coming from, and then tell us what happened?
There were several things in play. It kind of started really with the state ending up doing appointing Representative Robina to go around the state and to find out from homeowners, you know, test the waters. And he did that and came back with an awful lot of recommendations for the legislature. And as a result of his effort, legislation was put together in 2004 where a lot of, in fact, I think it was probably the largest condo bill change in a very long time. But part of that legislation was the establishment of two new entities, the Office of the Ombudsman and an advisory council on condominiums. And both the House and the Senate voted on basically the same bill to implement that. Along the same lines, at the same time, there was an organization, and I don't recall the full name, but it's called OPAGA. It's really a regulatory agency that investigates and makes reports on the state government agencies. And they had done a study, and they said, you know, homeowners are really complaining a lot that the DBPR is really slow in responding. They have 60-70 days before they hear from them. So all that stuff was coming together to revalidate the fact that the legislature had made a good decision establishing the Office of the Ombudsman. Unfortunately, Dr. Rizzo got the job. And
why did you say unfortunately?
Unfortunately, he got the job with nothing to go with it except the name. He had no organization, no funding, nothing. Okay, so he really was a one-man band, and I'm sure he was scratching his head, how am I going to get this going? But you have to understand that the same time that he was appointed, the statute was also in place to requiring him to perform. The new statute where if somebody petitioned his office to come and conduct an election, he had to deliver. So I believe he was appointed, I believe it was December in 2004. And for a month or so, when there was an election requirement, he had to run around and do these things all by himself. And it became very obvious that more and more people were hearing about it. More and more people were going to start petitioning him. And according to the statute, there is only three ways you could get someone to monitor elections. You had to be a state employee, you had to be an attorney, or you had to be a person qualified to do elections. Well, the state was never in the business of conducting elections, so there really wasn't anybody ready there, and there were no volunteers. So Dr. Rizzo immediately started going around trying to find volunteers, and that's how I came into the picture. He called me one night, and he said, hey, how would you like to be a monitor? And I said, yeah, what's that about? He says, conducting elections. He says, I've got one here tonight, and you and another fella can come with me. It's in Miami. And that's how I got started. I said, okay, I'll go. So I went that night to the election in Miami. I'll give you a little tidbit that goes along with this. The first time I met Rizzo, we went to Miami. We did the election. I came back home. I got home about 1:30 in the morning. The next day, of course, the report had to be written. So Dr. Rizzo called my home, and my wife answered. He said, hi, Betty. Could I start to Val? And my wife said, but my name is Doris. He says, did your husband go in the election last? She says, yes. She says, oh, I have the right place. So I said to Virgil when I got on the phone, I said, hey, look, I've been married 54 years. I met you one night. We go out together. My wife wants to know all about Betty. This is how Betty came into being. So from then on, everybody was calling her Betty. So that's a little aside. But anyway, it started one election, and then it became very obvious, how are we going to do all this stuff? There's no procedures, no organization, no nothing, and we started from scratch building it up. Luckily, you know, I was pretty savvy in the statute. I had been doing some background studying. I'm retired, so I had all the time, and I'm really in an HOA, but I was studying condos also. So the only thing we had going for us is our mutual knowledge of the statutes and knowing business-wise that things had to be done, and that's how we got the thing rolling. So we started organizing, and of course my first assignment was, why don't you figure out how we're going to get more people on board, and if we get them on board, what will they need to know? So I started putting together a training package and what have you, trying to find everything that I could. The first thing I grabbed was that Peter Dunbar had a book out on condos that was a very good book. And I said, well, we're going to use this to start training monitors. So we were using some factual statutory information to help us. And it went from there to growing and growing to a full-blown system. It took us quite a while to get it together, and we eventually rounded up more monitors, and we started conducting elections. And it all went on from there.
You said something quite startling right at the very beginning of the book. You said that the ombudsman was set up for failure, and the ombudsman's office was only in... Well, the ombudsman's office is still there, but Virgil Rizzo, I think, he's been on the show a couple of times, and he sort of, it's almost like he was put in front of a thick brick wall from day one and told to take care of the problems. As you said, no funding, no organization. He was appointed by the governor. The governor refused to meet with him. It was like a whole series of total.
Yeah. Well, if you think about it, Shu, one of his responsibilities that the legislature laid on him was that he was responsible to kind of look at the division. Remember now, the Opaga report had come out. Representative Rubano had gone around the state, listened to people, and they set up the Office of the Ombudsman, and now they're saying, you know, we've got to look at what's going on with the DPPR, and one of your jobs, Dr. Rizzo, is to tell us, you know, what needs to be changed. Well, if you're going to start telling the legislature what's wrong with an organization, you can't be reporting to that organization. Well, Dr. Rizzo wasn't reporting to that organization because it was out of the executive branch from the governor's office's appointment. However, for administrative purposes, he was attached to the DBPR, which kind of muddied the waters in them thinking that they were his boss in the sense. So here you have, how can you report on an organization that you would be belonging to? You know, it was very difficult, and the back and forth started real early in the game as to who was in charge of who and who should be reporting on who, and who should be monitoring who, and you can see how it all took off. And fortunately, Dr. Rizzo, if you know Virgil, he doesn't kowtow. He's a man of his own conviction, and he knew what his mission was. And then the torpedoes, he went ahead and did what he thought was the right thing to do. So he's making a lot of enemies along the way. So, you know, that's what I'm saying. It's kind of set up because I personally believe that probably, you know, had he been part of the Attorney General's office and totally separated from that department, things would have probably gone a little easier for him.
I think that, and from reading the book, I also understood that every time he did anything, or there were just these constant irritating blocks that were put in the way, which made it very difficult for him to do the job. I'm amazed at what you guys were able to accomplish, given all of the problems that were imposed on you, not the problems of dealing with HOAs. I think those were probably, believe it or not, the easier things
they
to
were.
Handle. It was the other stuff that was not so easy.
Yeah. If you have something that works properly from an organizational standpoint, the division had enforcement powers, and if there had been some real teamwork, they would have, you know, gotten in the ball game real early when Dr. Rizzo would find something wrong, and they could have worked very closely together to cut stuff in the quick and make everybody more effective, and there would have been no fighting back and forth. I think there was no efficiency in that sense. So in a way, I have to say, you know, that the idea of the Ombudsman's Office was an outstanding idea that the legislature came up with. However, the implementation of it was less than desirable. And I don't think if Dr. Rizzo had not gotten some real effective helpers, he would have failed. He would have never been able to do this all by himself.
You know, we've got a letter, and I usually do the letters after the break, but we have a question here, and I think it's going to fit in perfectly with what we're talking about. And this is from Sam in California, and the question is, can you and or your 500-pound guest, that's what he says, today comment on the existence of any state ombudsman program that has been in existence for more than 5 years, as well as any success of any state ombudsman program? I don't think, you can either agree or disagree with this, but from everything that I've seen, Val, I don't think any state ombudsman's program was ever designed to help the homeowners. I think every one of them has been a placebo. It's been a means for sucking more money out of the homeowners and probably into the pockets of the industry.
Yeah.
You want to comment on that?
Well, I don't have a lot of experience with the governmental ombudsman, but as an ex-IBMer, I can tell you the IBM ombudsman was really effective. We called them hatchet men. When the ombudsman came to our facilities, when he left, there was either a manager, a first-line and a second-line manager no longer had a job. He did OJT training by letting people see how he did his job, and you learned, you better do your job right, you're going to get canned. Now, that's in the industry. Now, I know that my father-in-law was in a nursing home here in Florida, and I know I used to go visit him a lot, and I saw on a bulletin board that they always had a big, bold telephone number to call the ombudsman. I don't know how effective the Florida nursing home ombudsman is, but I do know that people that contact him of people that can't get anything resolved by anyone else, which is what I understand to be the concept of an ombudsman, the court of last resort, if you will. So from a legislative standpoint, I know that Virgil used to say two things. Whenever he was asked, what can we do to help you do your job better? He always said two things. I need more money, and I need a bigger hammer. And I think that kind of ties into what that question is. An ombudsman with a little itty-bitty hammer is going to make a dent, maybe, depending how tough the surface is that he hits. So I think the key is, if you're going to have an ombudsman, you got to give him teeth, just like your laws. Your laws, Florida, we have some very good laws, but nobody enforces them. There's no teeth. So it's all about the teeth thing.
Do you have, and we're digressing just briefly, do you have any idea how the nursing home ombudsman is funded?
No, I don't know anything about it. Like I say, all I know is I know that when I was at, I used to go to a nursing home in New Smyrna quite a bit. And every once in a while, somebody would contact the ombudsman, and something got done. So I don't have the details, but apparently he's probably effective. I don't know.
Okay, because the program in Florida, the program in Nevada, which was the first, and just about every program there is, there's one in Virginia as well, it's at an additional cost. In Florida, I think it's $4 per door, right?
Yeah, what it is, it's really, the condo people pay $4 per door to the fund. That fund finances everything, including the ombudsman, the DBPR, and everything else.
Okay. Now, from that fund, $500,000, $500,000, was given to the Community Associations Institute for an education program. I know that there's a fund in Virginia. The advisory committee in Virginia is also is made up of members of CAI, and the money goes back into CAI. There's very little that actually, if anything, that ever goes into actually protecting and working for the homeowner. When they came up with the idea for an ombudsman in Virginia, I actually drove down to Richmond and lobbied against it because it was, it was ridiculous. It was a placebo. It was not going to do anything. But what it does is, it's another way of getting money out of the homeowners. It's another way of funding CAI's pet projects, and that money is then used.
Well, the other interesting thing is with that fund. Up until Representative Robano put a stop to it, annually they would sweep out that fund.
Right.
So if you think about it, the money stayed there and had been building over the years. When Dr. Rizzo was appointed, he could have been handed a lot of money to get operational right away. As it turned out, Representative Robano had to personally go get him some money.
And you weren't paid. I mean, the monitors were all
done. No, we're volunteers. No dollars from the state or anything.
No dollars from the state. And then there's this reluctance, and you've addressed it a couple of places in the book as well. There's this reluctance to sort of hold boards accountable or make them get some kind of education. And on page 29, folks, we're talking to Val Luce here, and his book is Condo Board Election Revolt, How Florida's First Condo Ombudsman Became the 500-Pound Gorilla. It's a fascinating book. It's a real eye-opener for all of you who are out there thinking, you know, gee whiz, we really need to get we need to get an ombudsman in here. You need to read this before you go any further with that notion, and maybe look for a different solution. But, one of the big things that you hear all the time, Val, is that association directors are only volunteers. And you said your response to that is that the quote, the quality of life for everyone in an association depends on the competency of their directors. If the directors are unwilling to take the time to learn their job, they shouldn't take it on.
That's correct.
And then you went on, further on in the book, and then there's also a reluctance to hold them accountable because, after all, they're only volunteers. You know, it could cost you $100,000, you could lose your home, but, you know, they're only volunteers, and if we don't, you know, if we hold them accountable, if we expect them to do the right thing, then nobody will volunteer.
Right.
You wanted some kind of, you wanted a bit of a hammer there, and you said, I stated that there's no behavior change if there are no consequences. That axiom is proven in spades when it comes to condominium associations. Poor behavior is unlikely to change until individual offenders pay the consequences. Forcing association members to pay fines for offenses committed against fellow members is insane.
That's right. There are two points I can make on that. Number one, I keep coming back to represent Julio Rubino, but I think you know why. He is the one that insisted that he wanted to have any new board member required to receive formal education. Well, they fought that and killed that out of his bill. But if that happened, a lot of these things would be taken care of. Secondly, there's a thing that doesn't make sense to me. If a board member misbehaves, and if the division, which has the power to enforce and fine, fined him for his misbehavior, guess who pays? And a special assessment is levied against the membership,
right,
who probably turned him in the first place.
Right.
And what I'm saying is, if you really went to the core of the issue, you would find that it's probably the CAM manager or the attorney that helped him do what he's doing. And if the DBPR did a full check, maybe you should start fining the people that give the lousy advice to those volunteers who don't know what they're doing, instead of fining the membership.
Well, and plus it's a disincentive to do anything about it,
sure,
because it's going to end up costing you money. So you might as well bite the bullet and go along with it. I mean, the whole program just doesn't make sense now.
And I'll give you another view. The view is these volunteers, if you deal harshly with them, you won't have volunteers. I know of several associations that people will not run because of that problem. A lot of people would be willing to be volunteers if they knew the rules of the game and if they knew that it would be managed or enforced properly. A lot of people are not afraid of the law or breaking the law. If they know what they're doing and do it right, that won't discourage them from running. But it will discourage honest people from running when there's already a bad board that they know that there'll be a minority on, and they don't want to be a party to that if things go down. So good volunteers tend to shy away.
You did this for, what, a little
15
over a year?
15 months.
15 months. Talk about your days. I mean, it was a full-time, probably more than a full-time job.
I worked 70-hour weeks. What I had to do is, when I received a petition, I would have to go online and pull the property appraiser's list, check all the names, get it all verified so that the ombudsman could approve it. Keep in mind that the ombudsman was the only person that would validate a petition. You can do all the homework, but in the end, he makes the decision. So you have to provide him all the materials that he can make the decision with. So that would take, in some instances, 4 hours, sometimes 3-4 days. Sometimes you had a lot of time because an election, you had a lot of lead time. Sometimes you didn't have lead time. I have one situation where an individual called me and he wanted to know how much time it would take for him to file a petition to have us come and conduct an election. I asked him, when was the election? He said, tonight. Couldn't help that guy.
We're talking to Val Lucier. Val is the author of a brand new book out called Condo Board Election Revolt, How Florida's First Condo Ombudsman Became the 500-Pound Gorilla. It's interesting reading, and there's so much stuff in here. I mean, I've literally got tabs all over the place. But we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk to Val some more and talk about what's in the book. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
They want me to get rid of my dog. Can I do that?
I'm being fined for leaving the garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help. I feel like I've left the American dream.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Sue Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and then untangle the truth about what's left of our property.
WBR Fairfax Radio, you're on The Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew, and on The Commons with us today we have Val Moore Lucier, author of Condo Board Election Revolt, How Florida's First Condo Ombudsman Became the 500-Pound Gorilla. Val, thank you so much for joining us. How did you, you talked a little bit about how you became a monitor, but how, okay, you did it for 15 months and you resigned.
Yeah.
You had enough.
Well, it was more than that. Actually, at the point in time where I decided, I told Virgil in January that I was going to be leaving. At the time, I had my two brothers and both their wives in real serious health condition. And I was concerned that, if something happened, I was gone for several weeks, he'd be in a real bind. And I said, I'm going to have to make some arrangements. So it was really a family health thing at the beginning. Well, it turns out that, I retired in May, and three of the four have already passed away. So they cooperated and stayed alive till I was able to finish my job, if you will. But that really concerned me because the amount of work I was doing for Virgil, I could not be away for weeks. I was involved in every aspect of this thing, and at the beginning, at that point in time, with the little staff that he had, he only had the secretary in the office, and he had two permanent staff handling all of his other problems, and I was handling the monitor part. And I told Virgil, I says, when I was at IBM, we did every year we were required to do an analysis of our exposures. And I says, your operation, Virgil, I have to tell you, I'm your exposure. Something happens to me. This one-fourth of your stool, one leg of that stool, election monitoring, will be down the drain. We have to do something. So fortunately, he got some funding. And in May, in April, he finally picked up a new employee who happened to be one of my old monitors.
Oh.
So I was able to train him and transfer everything to him so that I could retire in May. So it worked out very well. But, I was at the point where I knew that, something happened. And besides, it was getting to be very hectic. At my age, working 70-hour weeks was getting to a point where I was feeling it.
So you decide you're going to hang it up, you quit doing the monitoring, you stayed on with Virgil, you got your replacement trained, you were done, you got through with the stress, so you sat down and wrote a book.
Well, that's not really how it happened.
Oh, okay, you want to tell us?
Yeah, really what happened is I retired in May, and of course, 1st of June, Dr. Rizzo's appointment was rescinded while he was on a cruise. And he came home that Sunday night. He gave me a call, and I had read the newspaper, and we discussed it. I said, well, Virgil, now that this has happened, I says, what are you going to do now? Are you going to hang out a shingle and start helping all Floridians become a millionaire? Or are you going to sit down and write a book and become famous? I said, I'm not going to do either one, Val. He said, I'm just going to try to get healthy again. Try to get through all these operations. I says, okay, then I'll write a book. He says, okay. And we left it at that. But then the next couple of days, I happened to talk to Jan. He says, if you write the book, I'll get it published. I says, you will? I says, where are you so sure you can get a book published from a non-publisher? He says, I'll get the book published. I says, I'll tell you what, if you can get the book published, you can keep the revenue. He says, we've got a deal. An hour later, I get a call from Connie Young, his secretary. She says, Jan says, you're going to write a book. Do you need help? I says, are you kidding? So starting on June 5th, Connie and I worked round the clock, and we had a book written by July 29th.
Starting June 5th, you retired May 1, you started on the book, too. Wow.
And the reason I wasn't going to do this, but my wife says, you know, Val, you're really upset about, you know, what went on with Virgil. I said, yeah. She says, you know, you're the only one that can tell this story besides him, and he's no shape to do it. And she said, he says he's not going to write a book, so why don't you write a book? You wrote another one that you never got published. This one would probably get published. Jan promises. I says, all right. So she pushed me along. So anyway, Connie and I started working on this thing like crazy, day and night. And by, like I said, July 29th, the book was completed. It was in manuscript form. According to Writer's Market, it was ready to go. Okay, and what happened is Connie took all my pieces and she built me a Cadillac, basically. And the book, of course, Jan deals with volunteers, you know, so he had to find a graphic arts person to work on it. Well, at the time when we wrote it, the title of the book was The Ombudsman and I, and it had a tagline, from 0 to 60 to a full stop in 15 months. And Connie and I worked up kind of a temporary cover. We had a grayscale picture of an automobile steering wheel and a red and white stop sign right in the front of the car. And that's what I turned over to Jan. I says, it's your book. Do what you want with it. I'm done. So he got hold of a gentleman by the name of Jonathan D., who was a graphics person that worked up a real nice graphic cover for him. And on his cover, he had the old capitol, the new capitol. He had the seal of the state, the seal of the Senate, the seal of the House, and a small gorilla, all the size of a dime on our left-hand side. So later on, Joyce Starr, who's the publisher, came on to the scene, and she had one conversation with me that lasted a half an hour, and her and I were of the same mind. This cover was too busy. And in that one setting, we ended up with the cover that we have today and the title that we have today. So it was a total cooperative effort. So she took on the effort to finalize the publication. So over the Christmas and New Year's weekend, her and I went through the same frenzy that Connie and I had gone through. And what Joyce did, she put the racing stripes on that Cadillac. And we published the book, and that's what you have today.
I understand that I have a collector's version of the book.
Yes.
And would you tell us about the 500-pound gorilla?
The 500-pound gorilla. As you know, all through this 15 months, the advisory council kept getting into Virgil's back pocket about everything. And he took up an enormous amount of their time, and it was really none of their business in my mind. But anyway, I was at the Orlando Advisory Council meeting, and it was a pretty bad meeting. Everybody kept getting up and talking about the ombudsman's office, this, that, the other thing. So finally we got to the point where the chairman said, we're at the point where we're going to have to, we seem to not want to talk about this 500-pound gorilla that's in our living room, referencing Virgil. And I was so incensed at that point that I just shut my tape recorder off, packed my briefcase, and left. And when I got home, I had a gorilla with a pair of red boxing gloves, and I made a Velcro nameplate, Virgil the Ombudsman, and I took a picture of that. And I made him an 8x10. And there are several pictures that people took. It's on his desk. He's sitting at his desk at the office in Fort Lauderdale. And that was the gorilla. So when he left the job, believe it or not, that's the one item he got back. So it became our mascot, and it's kind of comical. But it's really sad because it really summarizes how other agencies who were supposed to be working hand in hand were viewing him.
And basically he did not have the power that he needed.
That's
or
right.
The authority he needed
exactly.
to get the job done. I mean, it must have been one frustrating
they
blow.
They kept second-guessing him. Why are you doing it? And there was a situation where they kept wanting to know who the monitors were. Who are these monitors? Like, what business is it of yours? That's the one part of the statute that you guys don't have nothing to do with, but they wanted to know. So we finally had a Miami meeting, a two-day meeting, where Virgil says, you all come on down, and we're going to put this to bed once and for all. At that meeting, he steps up and he says, you people have been wanting to know about my volunteer. I brought him in today, and you can ask him any questions you want. With that, he hands me the mic. I start saying my name. Before I finish my name, the chairman says, we don't have no time for this today, and goes on to another subject. The subject never came up again. So they were real interested in knowing who we were, right?
I think they were trying to find busy work just to sort of distract him, keep him doing. You know, it's typical. You also, you know, you had how many monitors?
In all, we had throughout the program we had about 18 monitors. And of course, the four permanent staff. So that's the whole crew. But the bulk of the monitors, the monitoring was done from here, you know, in the Fort Lauderdale, Miami, and the West Palm Beach area. So I would say the bulk of the elections were conducted by about 12 monitors.
So you had these people who... Presumably, they didn't work quite as hard as you did, being the chief monitor.
No, here's how it worked. All the monitors, the other volunteer monitors, all they had to do was come to the election and conduct the election. I brought the material. I did the background. I wrote the reports and filed them if I was present at that election. If for some reason a monitor went to an election by him or herself because it was a small election, then I would just give them their materials to go to the election, and they would conduct the election, and then they would have to write their own report, and I'd file it and process it. So I did the office work, if you will.
Val, there are a couple of things that in the book... that you talk about. One of them is that you'd have to have about 15% of the association petition to have the election monitored, right?
That's correct.
And what would happen when you verified that these people, you know, you did in fact have 15% of the eligible voters who had petitioned you, and that you were now in business and you were going to go and conduct the meeting? You wrote about the over-exaggeration of the fees that was going to be charged to the association. In some cases, the board members would tell the individuals that they would personally have to pay $5,000, $10,000, $7,000, whatever amount it was, just to scare them off, right?
Yeah. And, you know, that was never the case. In fact, there was only one association that ever had a bill that came up to that amount. It's interesting. This particular association required three elections, and we ended up doing the whole election, the management of an election, you know, first notice, second notice, getting the candidates, and doing the whole election. And that particular election, when Dr. Rizzo was dismissed, that was the single election that was shown or used in the newspaper to say a $3,000 election. Well, it was three elections and about a $1,400 tab to do an election for an association, which had roughly $1,000 worth of expense in terms of mailing and repro. So it's a $400 tab. On that particular association, I spent 5 months and 200 hours.
200 hours, and the 200 hours were for free.
Oh, yeah. No, no. If you figure, if you take the $1,400 and forget what I spent on buying the repro and the mailing, I made $258 in that election.
$258. I know that you had a schedule of fees, and it was something like $50 for an association with 100 members or less.
Is how the whole thing worked. The petition processing was 50 for 100 or less, then 100 for 100 to 300, and 150 for 300 and over. The actual election cost was $80 for contact hour doing the actual election for the chief monitor, and 50 for assistant monitors. We then charged $25 an hour travel time for getting two elections, and we charged 50 cents a mile. And that was right after the IRS approved a 48 cents claiming, you know, that you could put on your taxes. Doesn't mean you can't charge more, but you can't claim more than 48 cents. So we were charging 50 cents a mile. But that was mostly all local stuff. So if you did an election in Fort Lauderdale and you had monitors come from one end of town to the other end of town, a 20-minute ride down, 20-minute ride back, three monitors, now you figure $25 an hour divided by that amount was pennies. When you have attorneys that were attending at $325 an hour, and they'd have a couple attorneys there, and they were worried about the monitor cost of $80 an hour.
Yeah, and that's something you said. You remember a direct confrontation between the unit owner and the attorney, who, to my surprise, told the owner that he was receiving his regular fee of $325 per hour, portal to portal. The unit owner's subsequent question was, what are we getting for that tonight? It appears that the election monitors are doing all the work and you're doing the watching. Or better yet, are we paying you four or five times what we're paying him so that he can teach you how an election is supposed to be conducted? We were not very popular with that conduct.
Yeah, that guy did me a real favor that night.
You also said that approximately 10% of the associations that used our services chose to have at least two attorneys present. Why two? Your guess is as good as mine. As to the cost, you can easily do the math. Receiving a copy of several boards relied upon an interesting ploy, otherwise known as harassment.
Mm-hmm. We have one old little old lady took care of that, though, huh? They knocked on her door, and she says, if you come and ask me one more time why I signed that petition, I'm calling the cops. It stopped.
Yeah, you said that they would try to go and get them to take back their votes.
Reverse the petition, that's right. Or they would say, they didn't know what they were signing. And, you know, personally, I'd say to the guy, did you ever sign something you didn't read? And if you did sign it, does it invalidate it because you didn't read it?
Oh boy! but you had some giggles as well.
Oh yeah.
You know, there's a whole chapter here where you talk about.
You're not gonna laugh at Virgil with the ballot in his pocket on it.
I'll let you do that one. Election experiences. It must have been. I mean, it's probably been a fascinating experience.
It was.
My favorite one, though, is, because this is so, so, so typical of associations, is the parking offense.
Yeah, we were lucky the right guys won.
Tell us about it.
Well, you know, when you go to some of these elections, you know how it is in condos. There's very few parking spaces. It's hard to find. In fact, sometimes we'd have to say, well, where are we going to park? Well, I'll give you my parking space, make sure I'm in the lobby, you know, that kind of stuff. So we get to this election, and we get right near the entrance to the election, and there's a parking space open. And this is 10 minutes before the elections. We felt real good. So the monitor backed their car in there, and we got out. We went into the election. And, of course, it was a clean sweep that night. So when we came out, there's a sticker on a windshield, a ticket for parking backwards into a slot. So we took the ticket and said to the president, we just got this. He says, don't worry about this ticket. I'll take care of this one. So rank has its privilege.
Well, I mean, only in an association would people be concerned about whether you pulled in or backed into
they
a parking.
They knew exactly who we were. We were parked right next to the door. So, you know, there was a message there.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're going to ticket you. What do you suppose would have happened if your guys hadn't won?
We probably had our car towed away.
Oh, jeez.
I don't know. I'm guessing. It's kind of like you read the one about the maintenance man says there was an election there that day.
Yeah, tell that one. That was funny.
We go to this election, and we walk up to this door, and I said there's a gentleman with some tools, and I said, can you tell me where this building is? And I'm holding the announcement. He says, now, what are you doing here? He says, there's no election here today. I says, but I'm holding the election notice. He says, am I at the right place? He says, well, there's two identical buildings. It might be in that one over there. Says, okay, so I walk over to the next building. I open the door, and they're setting up for a Mahjong tournament. I said, oh, I guess it ain't here. So I go back, and the other monitor says to me, why don't we open that door? We opened the door where the maintenance man had been standing.
Yeah.
We opened the door. There's this big room with a stage. The board was up on the stage, and the cam manager had his table set up at the bottom of the stage. So we walked in and said, hi, where are the monitors? Thank you. We'll take over from here.
So they were trying to pull a fast one.
Once they would have started, you know, what would you have done? Walk in and say, hey, stop everything. You know, the process. So it was kind of suspicious.
You know, you're going to have to tell the Virgil one as well.
Virgil one? He had two. The first one was we had this election. And we had just finished going through the validation of the envelopes. We counted them and said, we got a different count. Well, one short. I looked on the floor, I checked it. Then I looked at the front row and I see Virgil, there's an envelope sticking in his pocket. So I went over, I said, is that what I think it is? He said, yeah, we haven't talked to him yet. Well, that was one envelope that we knew we wanted to talk to the attorney about before we accepted or rejected it, but the attorney hadn't arrived yet. So Virgil was holding the envelope. So the gig was whenever we had an election after that, whether Virgil was present or not, if there was a count discrepancy, so where's Virgil? We got to check his pockets. And then he had the one that... Well, we were going to try this new handheld letter opener. And the way they work is you tap the short end of the envelope and use the cutter on the other end. And
that was the first time.
So Virgil tapped the envelope on the long side, the horizontal side, and cut it. He cut the ballot in half. So we had to scotch tape it, and I guess that was the end of the letter openers.
So you had to open them manually.
Yeah.
One of the other ones, I mean, you say you held, elections were held in all manner of places, parking lots, property manager's office, but you had one titled Flush with the Facilities.
Oh, yeah. that one was obviously the president was a female. Wanted to ask where we to set up. She says, as far as I'm concerned, you can set up in a bathroom. And I said, well, statute won't allow me to do that because you won't be able to watch the proceedings.
They wanted you to go to the bathroom,
yeah.
Huh?
They, you know, what are you going to do?
I don't know. I mean, it's just unbelievable. But you did run into problems.
Oh, yeah, all the time. And, you know, we're able to correct most of them because, you know, we had a methodology and we always tried to get there early and get set up so that we'd know what was going on. And, you know, we always had to be on our toes.
You had the guy who conducted the meeting in Spanish, except no one in the audience spoke Spanish. Mm-hmm. They spoke
but I had a Spanish-speaking monitor.
you were prepared.
Oh, yeah. We had him sit in the audience till his term expired 2 hours later.
And we're going to end on believe it or not, our hour is over with, but... you made a comment. I think it's a very poignant note. You said that the bulk of the problems are in Broward, Miami-Dade, Palm Beach counties. It's where 90% of all the elections I was involved in takes place. I disagree with the county or with the council when it claims there are no serious problems with respect to quality of life. And this is the thing. The ACC members don't look into the eyes of desperate and disenchanted owners. It must have underscored when you went and talked to the people. It must have underscored the problems that existed in associations for you, right?
Yes, and it was very hard and frustrating because you knew that your job was to do two things. Like I kept training my monosound. Were VCs without the black pajamas, and that's so that they remember the job. The job was validate the envelope, count the ballots. Any other problems? Contact the division and report it. We can't do a thing for you.
Yeah,
unfortunately, when those people saw somebody from the state coming in, they got this feeling, my God, I'm finally going to get some resolution. And I'd have to say, sorry, I can't help you. And a lot of them would turn around and say, why do we get you here for? You got me here to make sure you got a fair and impartial election. That's all I can do for you. So it was frustrating in that sense. And you knew, you know, had you had a different arrangement with the division, a closer working relationship, and these things, a lot of times you found out these problems way before the election, and you could have probably worked together and say, hey, you're not conducting this election. You're going to reschedule. You're going to rerun a second notice or this kind of stuff. Unfortunately, we could only walk in and do what we were allowed to do and no more. In fact, a lot of elections ended up in a runoff requirement, and the statute didn't allow us to come back to do the runoff. And we tried to get that changed and say, if it was a petitioned election, we should be able, if the petitioner or the association wants us to come back to finish the job, we couldn't. And every time we were asked to do that, so the statute doesn't allow us to do that.
Val, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, my dear.
I really appreciate it. I'm sure that, you know, a lot of people, I hope the book sells because I really think that... sells well because I really think there's a lot of information here that
I do
be very
too
helpful.
Because the funds will help the people of Florida to get some legislation changed because that's where all the money is going to go.
We'll put a link on my webpage for it. So, but Val, thank you so
much.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us on the Commons today. Stay with you. On the Commons was produced by OTC Multimedia Productions. See you all next week. Again, thanks for joining us. See you all next week.
Finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to Justice 4HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations,
It's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos. Someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid. All your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone. United, we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine. And enjoy those precious golden years. Stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos. Someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.